Welcome to the Gulf Coast Life Book Club. I'm your host, Carrie Barber. Today, we hear an encore presentation of my conversation with Julie K. Brown, the investigative reporter with the Miami Herald. 7 years ago, almost exactly to the day, the Miami Herald began publishing a series of Brown stories on the Jeffrey Epstein sex trafficking case. Her reporting brought about federal indictments for Epstein and his partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, caused then-Labor Secretary Alex Acosta to step down, and set in motion compensation in the millions of dollars for Epstein's victims. Brown later collected her reporting in a fascinating book called Perversion of Justice. With the so-called Epstein files beginning to trickle out from the Justice Department, it's a good time to revisit our conversation and read Julie K. Brown's book if you haven't yet. Julie K. Brown, thank you so much for joining us on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thanks for having me.
This is such important work, and I'm really thrilled to get the chance to talk to you about it. Jeffrey Epstein was sexually abusing young girls for decades. It was sort of an open secret. He served a very light sentence in 2008. Then the case seemed to sort of fade away until you resurrected it. Can you tell us how that came to be?
Well, I, you know, like a lot of reporters, were vaguely aware of this case. And what happened was I was doing a lot of stories on Florida prisons. And as a result of that, I knew from interviewing women in the prison system that sex trafficking was a big problem here in Florida. So doing my research on sex trafficking in Florida, Jeffrey Epstein's name kept coming up. And so I just, every time I read something about it, I just shook my head. I couldn't understand, how does this happen? How does a man commit a crime like this and essentially get away with it? So I started thinking about doing something and maybe digging into it. And coincidentally, right at that time, President Trump nominated Alex Acosta to be Labor Secretary. And I was aware by that time that it was Alex Acosta who, as the U.S. attorney in Miami during the Epstein case, signed off on this unbelievably lenient plea bargain with him. So I expected that when he was grilled during his Senate confirmation hearings that it would come up. And to my surprise, it did come up, but he was barely questioned about it. And it was apparent to me that the senators didn't understand the scope of the crimes that Epstein had committed.
This case started with the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office, and then it was moved to the FBI. But even the FBI gave Epstein special treatment. It seemed like he was tipped off at every turn. Did you ever feel overwhelmed at the level of corruption you were encountering as you researched this story or reported this story?
Let me just go back for a second to an important point. You said it started with the Palm Beach Sheriff's Department, and that's really, a lot of people assume that, but it started with the Palm Beach, the town of Palm Beach Police Department. And they did a fine job investigating this case. The problem happened when the police took it to the prosecutors, the local prosecutor in Palm Beach, Barry Krischer, and that's when they started hitting, they were hitting, you know, hitting a wall, really, in their inability to continue the investigation. You know, as to the corruption, I mean, I say, as I explain in my book, this isn't necessarily the kind of corruption where you see one person slide a suitcase full of money under the table to another person. The kinds of favors that were done weren't illegal. They didn't find any evidence that these kinds of things that the lawyers were doing were illegal. And so, unfortunately, it continues to this day, you know, that this kind of underneath the, you know, table plea bargaining is still happening today.
Interesting. And thank you for that correction. I know you outlined that difference in your book, and I still got it wrong. So thank you for that.
It's confusing, I know.
But of course, you did run into some ethical people along the way, a couple of the police officers you worked with, a couple of the lawyers, and of course, you and your team. After doing all this work and now kind of reflecting on it, do you have any insight into what makes people do the right thing versus take the payout and keep their mouth shut or take the job or whatever they may get out of not prosecuting somebody?
Well, I think, for one thing, I think the tide has hopefully turned a little bit in the wake of the Me Too movement. I started this project before the Me Too movement, and it happened in the midst of when I was investigating it. And we've seen a sea change in the way that I think the public, the media, and even law enforcement, to some degree, are handling these kinds of cases. I'm hopeful that they're handling them more seriously than they did in the past. I had been told by a number of prosecutors that this is a case that should be studied in law schools, and that this is something that, you know, that they're going to think twice about doing in the future, given everything that's happened.
Do you think that the FBI could have made more progress with victims if they knew better how to talk to survivors of sexual abuse?
Well, the victims' lawyers, a couple of them told me that the way that they were questioned by the FBI almost made them feel like they had done something wrong. And, you know, should be concerning, because these were underage girls, you know, 13, 14, who were made to believe that they had done something wrong, or that they might even be arrested. And that really is not the way you handle a case like this, especially when you're dealing with minors.
And in the time that you've been working on this story, have you noticed any improvement, or have you seen any difference in the way law enforcement handles cases like this?
Well, I know one thing is that I think that they're working more hand in hand with people like mental health counselors that can help guide them with cases involving, you know, not only sexual assault, but you know, there's, you know, a movement, I think, to help police deal with the mental needs of some of the people that they have to, you know, respond to who are committing crimes or who are unruly.
One of the victims, Courtney Wilde, said that she's quoted in your book as saying he victimized people he thought no one would listen to, and he was right. I feel like Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, who's one of his accomplices, had kind of a sixth sense about who to choose, who would put up with the abuse and not tell anyone. Many of them were poor, many of them came from troubled homes, etc., but some of them didn't, and they just seemed to have the sixth sense. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, they groomed them, and the grooming process, if anybody has studied it, I mean, it is a real phenomenon how predators are able to groom them. And they start just very simply, like, you know, with some of these girls, he didn't right away rape them. He would talk to them about, you know, where you go to school, what kind of grades do you get, you know, and that he would insinuate himself in some of these girls' lives. And then as they got more and more comfortable, then he would start molesting them. So this was sort of a process that he had perfected, really. And, you know, there were girls that went there and went out screaming that they weren't going to ever come back, and didn't, you know, so it didn't work with everyone. But he perfected exactly how to, you know, what girls were going to do this, and who was most vulnerable.
Yes. It's kind of sickening to think how many years of practice he had. You write in the book about you became an emancipated minor at 16. Do you think that's why you had a kind of a special passion for getting someone to finally listen to these girls and finally look out for these girls? I mean, one of the things I really loved about your book and your series of newspaper articles is you're one of the only people that the girls, the victims, would talk to.
Well, I didn't really consciously think about that. I've been doing this kind of work for, you know, 30 years. I've always covered crime, and in the course of covering crime, you cover victims. So and sometimes young victims. So I wasn't conscious of it, but I will say when I was writing the book, I became more conscious of it, because I remembered things in the interviews, you know, because I had to re-listen to them. And, you know, when you write a newspaper story, it's a lot smaller. You have to have four corners to it. And, you know, you only have a certain amount of space. So in revisiting these interviews and also conducting additional interviews, I just recalled parts of my past, you know, and realized that perhaps some of that played a part in the fact that I was able to understand where they were coming from. Even the parents who had, you know, Courtney's mom, you know, she was very honest, brutally honest about her feelings as a parent at the time. But, you know, I remembered my mother and how, you know, how she struggled too. You know, she had to work, you know, 2-3 jobs sometimes. And so I understood that, and maybe not other reporters would really understand, you know, the trap that she fell into.
And as I heard you say somewhere, or maybe it was in your book, you can make sort of one mistake at that early age and it just determines the path of the rest of your life if you're not careful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could have really, you know, I was just fortunate. I had some good people around me at the time who I mentioned in my book, who sort of nurtured me and nurtured my creative passions in writing. So I was fortunate, but you know, these girls weren't all so fortunate.
Yes. One of Epstein's tricks was to offer a job or a big donation to someone who he felt could do him harm. Did he ever offer you a job or a donation to the Miami Herald or anything like that?
No. We weren't on his radar at all, and I was glad we weren't, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I just think he just underestimated what we were doing. I mean, he ignored all the outreach that we did, including going to his house and trying to talk to him in person. He ignored it all. So I think he just underestimated. He figured there had been a number of stories written over the years about this case. So I think he just thought, well, it's just another story, you know?
Yes. Okay, I want to ask you about Rick Bradshaw, but I may get this wrong too, but he's the sheriff of Palm Beach County, correct?
That's correct.
And he oversaw that extremely lenient plea deal that Epstein got in 2007 and 8, correct?
No, that's not. It wasn't. It was the prosecutor. It was Barry Krischer that ultimately helped, you know, along with federal prosecutors, that plea deal. Rick Bradshaw is the sheriff of Palm Beach County. He's probably one of the, if not the most powerful figure in Palm Beach. And his office got the job of supervising Epstein while he was incarcerated. Instead of going to a state prison like most people convicted of these kinds of crimes, Epstein's lawyers managed to finagle a situation where Epstein was allowed to be in the county jail. And while he was in that county jail, which was under the supervision of Bradshaw, you know, he had his own private wing. He had a TV area. He was allowed to have his lawyers sit there and babysit him all day. And then eventually he was also given this work release whereby he could leave his valet, his own personal valet would pick him up early in the morning, take him to a nice luxurious office in West Palm Beach, which happened to be like right beside his lawyer's office. And he had his own private detail that he paid the sheriffs to supervise him. So imagine the conflict with that, where you're paying the guy who's supposed to be or the woman who's supposed to be supervising you. So these corrections, or I should say these sheriff's deputies that did this detail, they didn't really monitor him. They just sat outside his office as people came and went, including young women. So he was in that office more than he was behind bars.
And Bradshaw was recently reelected, wasn't he, as sheriff?
Yes.
And I know Florida State Senator Lauren Book has called for an investigation of Bradshaw, I believe. Do you know what the status is on that?
Well, they just released the results of the investigation, I want to say, like maybe 2 or 3 months ago. And, you know, they didn't find any wrongdoing, although it's pretty telling to me that they don't mention Bradshaw's name in the investigation at all. It was mostly into whether Epstein received any special treatment, but they didn't mention Bradshaw. So they interview all these people except for Bradshaw, it seems like, you know, or the people that would have had knowledge whether Bradshaw was, you know, had given his blessing to some of the privileges that Epstein received.
Hmm. So I'm not, it's not a spoiler to, because you named a chapter of your book, Jeffrey Epstein Didn't Kill Himself. Given the history of the case, his alleged suicide did seem awfully sketchy. Can you say more about that?
Well, it's just, this case really from start to even right now, the main theme of this case is how much we don't know and how much we don't know it because authorities have been keeping a lid on it. And they, you know, they seal documents, they redact documents, they allow people in this particular case, the two corrections officers that were on duty at the time were allowed to get, they got some kind of a plea bargain that we don't know what it is, you know, but they're out of prison and we just don't know what happened. And one of the reasons is because authorities aren't telling us, they're not being transparent in what they have and what they don't have. You know, there have been a lot of questions that were raised, you know, by his own brother. His own brother Mark doesn't believe that he committed suicide. His lawyers didn't believe he committed suicide. He had only been in jail for like a month. It seemed to me a little early in the process for him to throw in the towel, especially since he was the kind of person that believed he was above the law. He had beaten the rap before. His lawyers were prepared to argue that the agreement that he received in Florida was a global settlement where, you know, he couldn't be charged in other jurisdictions for essentially the same kind of conduct. So it seemed early in the process. And then, of course, you have Dr. Michael Bodden, who was at the autopsy hired by his brother, and he doesn't believe Epstein committed suicide. You know, three bones broken in his neck. Epstein wasn't a large man, you know, and, you know, he was also the kind of man that had everything done for him. The idea that he would have been able to do anything that would have broken three bones in his neck all by himself is just, you know, flies in the face of common sense, really.
Yes. All right. I want to talk about Bruce Springsteen.
I just saw him on Broadway when I was in New York. Yeah.
How was that? Oh,
that was absolutely wonderful. Yeah, it was a real, real treat.
Oh,
for me.
I mean, you talked in the book about, first of all, I just want to say I'm so in awe of the work you did on this series. And then to put this book together, which I think you wrote it very quickly. I'm just amazed at your productivity. And you talk in the book about how listening to Bruce Springsteen's music sometimes kept you going at the end of a dark day during this investigation. Can you say more about that, how his music helps you?
Well, you know, Bruce Springsteen is a real chronicler. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it, but he chronicles in his music the plight of everyday people, you know, in a way that, in my mind, no musician has done ever. And so, you know, here in this story, I'm chronicling the plight of these girls and their families and how, you know, I remembered one girl said, well, you know, I was stupid to do this, but all I remember thinking was that, you know, I was wearing the same pair of shoes for so long that I just couldn't wear them anymore. And I went there because I wanted to get money to buy a new pair of shoes. And, you know, those kinds of stories, I was sort of telling the kinds of stories that I hope to tell in a way that in my mind, Bruce is able to tell. Of course, much better than me, but I've found comfort in listening to those stories and just the mundane part of life. You know, I wrote part of the book during the pandemic, and he had a program on live from my home to yours. And so when at the end of the day, I turned it on and I was, you know, cooking dinner, you know, it was from my home to yours. I almost felt like, you know, he was there and it was just a source of comfort for me at a time when I was writing a dark story and was very isolating because also I was in the pandemic and I wasn't really going anywhere. So I did that for my kids when they were little too. I would pick some kind of piece of music and I would play it all the time to give them comfort. And even to this day, if I turn on that piece of music, it comforts them.
Oh, that's really nice. Have you had a chance to meet him or talk to him or
no?
Yeah.
No.
I want to point people to the Miami Herald website, too, to see the short documentaries that you and your colleague Emily Michaud made, where we see the girls talking about the case and about their abuse. And it's really very moving. Is that the best place for people to go, the Miami Herald website?
Yeah, and if they have trouble with that, they can also, it's on YouTube as well. So if they Google, search on YouTube, Jeffrey Epstein and maybe victims, they should pop up because they're on YouTube too. And, you know, the important part of the series really was the real heroes of this were these women who were able to let us film them at a point when no one had really asked them about these crimes, these things that had happened to them, you know, over a decade earlier. So this was their first time, you know, I've said to Emily a couple of times, you know, no one will ever catch that rawness, that horrible, horrible trauma and horror in the same way again, because we were the first ones to really interview them and they were brave enough to share that with us.
Yes. All right, I want to wrap this up. I'm aware of your time. Is there anything else that you would like to add that I haven't asked you about?
Well, the only other thing that I've been talking a lot about is I did this at a time when local news is really struggling. You know, the Herald, just like a lot of other papers, you know, they've had cutback after cutback and, you know, we've had layoffs and furloughs and, you know, it was at the point where my salary was really going down every year instead of going up, and newspapers in some communities are disappearing altogether. So, you know, I look at this as a story of triumph for local papers and regional papers like ours, that this is, you know, why it's important to support your local newspaper.
Yes, thank you for saying that. I just got a subscription to the Miami Herald because of your book.
Thank you.
Julie K. Brown, thank you so much for joining us on the Gulf Coast Life Book Club.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to Julie K. Brown for being on the show today. Her book is Perversion of Justice, The Jeffrey Epstein Story, and it is an amazing read. And now, what's out in paperback? Lacey Crawford's stunning memoir, Notes on a Silencing, is now in paperback. This searing account could be considered a companion piece to Perversion of Justice. It details the author's sexual assault by two fellow students at the elite St. Paul's Prep School in New Hampshire, and the school's subsequent orchestrated campaign to cover up the crime and denigrate Crawford for reporting it. This was an Encore episode that originally aired August 4th, 2021.